I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 222 years ago, Thomas Jefferson proudly planted 16 China berries at the edge of the West Lawn at his estate in Monticello. The trees didn't do that very well that far north. They were likely killed by the cold. And a few years back, the man who is now head gardener at Monticello, Peter Hatch, decided to recreate that circle of 16 China berries. Trouble was, he couldn't find any. In the years since Jefferson's time, the trees become regarded as something of a weed, a scruffy little trailer park tree, the Cheney ball, or as Peter Hatch describes it, a brittle, pestilential nuisance. But Hatch persevered. He found young and healthy China berries. He planted them, just where and just as Thomas Jefferson had. And they died of the cold, just as Jefferson's trees had 200 years earlier. It was one of Peter Hatch's first years recreating the gardens of the former president. Peter's now been at it close to 30 years. He is with us this hour, and we'd like to have you join us. Why is it important to maintain an historic garden like the one at Monticello? What does a garden tell us about the person who originally designed it? And what does this garden tell us about the philosophy of a man who wrote about the power of the earth and the laws of nature in the Declaration of Independence? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As I mentioned, Peter Hatch is with us from a studio in Charlottesville, Virginia. He's director of gardens and grounds at Monticello and has overseen the restoration of that garden, I guess now, Peter, for the last 28 years. Does it seem that long?
It does indeed sometimes seem that long.
Were you in the garden before you came to the studio this morning?
I wasn't. Yeah, I was. I was out doing some weeding. It's become that time of year when a lot of things are coming up, and a lot of energy is devoted to keeping out the bad plants as well as fostering the good ones.
So a difficult time of year in the garden?
Well, it's hot and humid, and there's a lot of things growing right now, and a lot of things that need control.
Jefferson, when he wrote about the garden, wrote about this kind of march through the seasons, how one flower would give way to another and there'd be different sort of moments. Do you break it down in much the same way?
Yeah, I think it's nice, particularly the flower gardens, to see them as being, like Jefferson referred to them, as sort of the acts in a play. And the tulips would come up and perform their show and be replaced by the lilies, and the lilies would do their thing and retire the sidelines and receive their applause and be replaced by the tuberoses later on in the season. And Jefferson referred to the flowers themselves as being like the belles of the day who, after flowering, retire to the more interesting office of reproducing their like. Lovely poetry sometimes when Jefferson talked about gardening.
And was he more about the flowers or the vegetables or the trees, or was he a sort of equal opportunity gardener?
I'd say the trees probably occupied first place in his hierarchy of favorite plants, and then probably came vegetables and then flowers. But I think his interest in gardening really arose from a truly wide-eyed curiosity about the natural world. He said that there's not a shoot of grass that springs uninteresting to me.
So was it a scientific draw into the garden for him, or was it a place to go and relax and clear his head? Was it more spiritual? What have you figured out after all these years of working in that man's garden?
Well, I think it's both, and that's what makes it really a fairly profound experience for Jefferson. The fact that that he said that the greatest service which can be rendered in any country is to add a useful plant to its culture. And Jefferson definitely had a scientific bent when it came to growing 330 varieties of vegetables and keeping a 700-page diary of the comings and goings of Carolina beans and asparagus. But I think he also sees sort of the human part of gardening and part of Jefferson when he went to plant flowers with his daughters and granddaughters and design rather elaborate grottos around his north spring and generally sort of participate in the motions of the physical world. So you get a little bit of the scientist, but I think you also get a little bit of the creative personality of Thomas Jefferson at the same time. Some biographers have titled their studies of Jefferson "The Head and the Heart." And I think you see both the scientific Jefferson, but you also see sort of the passionate, imaginative figure at the same time when it comes to gardening.
I want to go back, if I can, Peter, to something that you said a couple of moments ago, and that the Jefferson line about the greatest service which could be rendered to a country is to add a new plant. Is that sort of close to what he said?
Yeah, that's right. And Monticello became a botanic garden and experimental station of really new and unusual plants that are brought literally from around the world. And you could describe the gardens as sort of this Ellis Island of new and unusual introductions. And he would grow 38 varieties of peach or 27 varieties of English pea and then make these sweeping proclamations about the finest fig he'd ever tasted or the greatest lettuce he'd ever known. And I think he looked at plants as sort of a vehicle for social change. He introduced a rice variety into the United States under the penalty of death from Italy and hoped to move low-country Carolina rice growers away from their malarial-ridden swamps to higher, healthier Piedmont soils. He looked at the possibilities of planting sugar maple trees in central Virginia and talked, at least in theory, about alleviating the slavery of African Americans in the Deep South and their reliance on sugarcane culture with the culture of sugar maple trees in central Virginia and the labor of what he called only children. So I think he looked at plants as sort of a vehicle for social change.
Do you think he was blowing smoke, or do you think that he really did think that, you know, the introduction of rice in a certain place could change the country?
Yeah, I think it was a genuine vision. But like with a lot of things with Jefferson, there's a great gap between the vision and the reality. Gardening at Monticello is a difficult chore. A mountaintop is a difficult place to garden. It was an unruly plantation structure. So I think that in theory, like with a lot of things with Thomas Jefferson, was one thing, and then the reality became a totally different one.
So he must have had two different philosophies about his role as a gardener, because if I'm not mistaken, when he set his eye to the grounds of the White House at the turn of the century, he was keen at that time that all the plants and all the shrubs be American. Is that right?
Right. He had sort of this proprietorial pride in some ways in the natural productions of Eastern North America. And when he was serving as minister to France, he would grow Indian corn in his garden and show off plants and seeds that he imported from the United States. And he planted a lot of wildflowers in the flower gardens at Monticello. And Jefferson's only published book, of course, The Notes on the State of Virginia, was written in large part to refute the theories of European scientists who believed in sort of this biological determinism, that the excessive humidity in the eastern United States resulted in an inherent degeneracy of our plants and our animals and even our native people. So Jefferson was all out in terms of promoting the natural productions of our part of the world.
Now, how much of what you do is a kind of detective work in going back to figure out, you know, which of the, I forget the number, 38 kinds of peaches that Jefferson had at Monticello? Were his notes that good? Are the Latin names of the plants all there for you to nail them, Peter?
No, it's not really a firm, sometimes detective work. There's a lot of interpretation. In some ways, it's sort of a literary search. You're looking at names primarily. You're looking also for descriptions in the Jefferson period for what a vegetable looked like, or what the Vega Loggia peach was, or the Muscat of Alexandria grape, how that was depicted either in written form or in illustrated form. And that gives you an idea of what you're looking for when you go back to try and retrieve some of these Jefferson varieties of plants. And we've had our successes and failures in doing that.
Tell me about the breast of Venus peach, because that's an interesting story.
Yeah, the breast of Venus peach was one of Jefferson's 38 varieties of peach that he cultivated at Monticello. And he got it from an Italian named Filippo Mazzei. And the peach is still being grown in Europe, and we imported it a number of years ago, and it had to be quarantined for a number of years at the USDA research station in Beltsville, Maryland. And we had a great image of the breast of Venus from a work by an Italian named Giorgio Galeazzo in 1817, and he actually drew the peach from Filippo Mazzei's garden, which was this holy coincidence. But anyway, we imported
it. Did it look like a woman's breast?
It did indeed. It had a nipple, and it was quite lovely in all its different aspects.
And so you guys were pretty excited to see what was going to come from this tree when you finally got it out of quarantine.
It was indeed quarantined for some 10 years when we went to retrieve it and bring it back to Monticello, and we grew it for 3 years, and it began bearing peaches, and it was the wrong thing. and it gave us more than a vicarious commiseration with Jefferson's own problems with importing plants from long distances. He had problems with pirates on the wild seas and bad road systems and poor transportation. And a lot of things that came to Jefferson were actually dead on arrival. And we have sometimes similar problems with bureaucracy and with names and so forth, but they're truly modern problems that enable us to kind of, again, commiserate with Jefferson's own issues of importing and growing plants.
He was actually kind of honest about this in a way. Like, he didn't mind writing in his garden book how many times he'd failed at something, to either bring something in or bring it to life or keep it alive.
Well, you know, he was an experimenter, and you could perhaps say that based on what's recorded in his garden book, that few gardeners failed as often as Thomas Jefferson, or at least confessed to failure as unrelentingly as he did. And he had almost a holistic view toward the gardening process. He said that in gardening, the failure of one thing is repaired by the success of another. And when the Hessian fly was eating up his wheat crop, he was much more concerned about learning the life cycle of this destructive insect rather than the fact that his wheat crop was about to go down the drain. And he believed in sort of this wholesome balance between wild nature on the one hand and the cultivated garden on the other. And ironically, today we sometimes look at gardening as being almost warlike. We use military images to describe the gardening process. We're out to wipe out these insects or these weeds. So it's nice to fall back upon Jefferson's more balanced view of this tension that exists between nature and the garden.
Just pick some of the words that Peter Hatch is using to describe Jefferson's garden at Monticello, this wild nature and the cultivation, the idea of the man as an experimenter, as something of a dreamer. Clearly there was more going on in the man's mind than just gardening there, because when you look at the political history of the man, those same words, the descriptions of the nation at his time, come up as well. We'd like to talk a little bit further about what we can learn about a person from a garden like this. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support for The Connection comes from...
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. The magic of radio this hour takes us to the garden at Monticello with Peter Hatch, who is in charge of what Jefferson planted back in the early 1800s. 1826 was the year that Jefferson died, and it was really almost in the weeks and the months after that that all the work that he put into his garden started to be taken apart as neighbors came to clip little things, and people who lived in the estate afterwards didn't take care of it. 1977, Peter moved in. They have worked on the ornamental forest and the south orchard and the garden pavilion, all sorts of things that involve the recreation of the garden as Jefferson knew it. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Charleston, South Carolina. And Michelle is with us. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. I was wondering if your speaker was aware that the rice cultivation from the past is coming back, particularly here in South Carolina in the Lowcountry. There's a guy named Dick Schultz who is growing Carolina Gold rice. I'm sure it's not exactly the rice that Thomas Jefferson tried to grow, but it's a variety that was known all over the world and was considered the primary crop in South Carolina up until the Civil War.
And did it stop then, Michelle?
Yeah. A number of reasons. One of them had to do with it as the century moved on, hurricanes destroyed the very complex network of dams and dikes that had been erected in Lowcountry, South Carolina, mm-hmm. which proved to be a more amenable place than the tidewater part of Virginia, although they're very similar. But the connection back to Jefferson even includes slavery, because many scholars believe that slaves were imported from specific parts of West Africa because they were geniuses at developing the kind of dikes and dams that would allow this kind of water culture to come back. And, of course, when you tour the Lowcountry or drive, you can see the remnants of these old dikes and dams that flooded at one time. But anyway, this guy is bringing back Carolina Gold rice.
And Peter Hatch, are you watching the kind of return to this kind of gardening that Michelle's talking about in places other than Monticello?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to hear about the Carolina Gold rice being revived, because it's a it's a great part of the tradition of the Lowcountry of the Carolinas. And I think that Jefferson's participation, Jefferson's upland rice never worked, like a lot of things that he tried. And that just shows you that the failure of one thing is repaired by the success of another. So it's great to see this happening, and it's in the Jeffersonian spirit, and I hope that it's a lot more successful than some of Jefferson's experiments, like the upland rice, which never really took hold because it was meant to be grown in really the high country, the dry lands of the Piedmont.
One of the vegetables that is always linked to Jefferson is the tomato, and I'm wondering if in fact he should carry responsibility for popularizing that fruit in this country. What have you learned about that, Peter?
Well, the tomato was being grown many years before Jefferson cultivated it as a culinary vegetable at Monticello, but he was certainly a pioneer in pushing its cultivation. But his influence was probably perhaps more local. His son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph, who was an excellent farmer, gave a talk before the Albemarle Agricultural Society a few years before Jefferson died, and he talked about plant exploration and about how our lives have been improved by introducing these new things. And he mentioned specifically the tomato and how 10 years earlier, around 1812, no one was growing the tomatoes, but by 1822 everyone was, because they believed they quickened the blood in the summertime.
Well, early on, people were kind of a little dodgy about eating it, right? Wasn't?
Yeah, there was a lot of resistance to eating tomatoes, and it's associated with some other nightshade family plants, so there was association with poisonous plants. And that may have been, the lore about the tomato might be a little bit overstated, because people were growing it more and more, and particularly Mediterranean peoples were growing it quite commonly. And our discussion about how the tomato was really unpopular in some ways maybe just a sort of a geographic thing, because certainly the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Italians were eating the tomatoes in Jefferson's lifetime quite prominently.
Peter Hatch is Director of Gardens and Grounds at Monticello. He's with us this hour. We'd like to hear from you. We're going next to Blacksburg, Virginia. Elizabeth's on the line. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. I've just come in from doing a lot of hot gardening this morning to help pay off my rent, and I'm exhausted, and I don't feel I would have any inclination to do any lyrical writing about the work I've been doing, and it makes me wonder how much Jefferson might have accomplished without the help of his slaves.
And would he, if he was doing all that hot work himself, would he have had the time to do the writings? Fair
exactly.
Question, yeah.
Well, I think there was sort of a balance there. Certainly slavery was an integral part of the plantation at Monticello, and it's difficult to generalize about the labor in the gardens. In the flower gardens, Jefferson's daughters and granddaughters did a lot of the planting, and there's a lovely image about how Wormley Hughes, who was the enslaved head gardener, at a time when the whole family was gathered together, and Wormley was sort of considered almost a part of the family, he was armed with a spade and hoe. He was obviously preparing the beds for the daughters and the granddaughters to do the planting. And Jefferson himself, he was in the 70s at that time, he was labeling the plants and also spacing them apart as the granddaughters were setting them in the ground. One of Jefferson's slaves, Isaac, recalled that Jefferson himself would work at a right hard pace for about a half an hour in the cool of the evening. And particularly in the kitchen garden, Jefferson was actually sowing the seeds in the land. The hard work, the weeding, and the preparing of the ground was generally carried out by a series of enslaved head gardeners. There was one larger-than-life figure named Gray George, who went on from being the sort of the lead vegetable gardener to the only African-American overseer at Monticello responsible for the cash crops of tobacco and wheat. And in the orchard and the vineyards, ironically, there was a series of European gardeners who were generally in charge of growing grapes and cultivating peaches. So labor
well,
really...
This particular situation that you're describing makes me wonder what relevance his writing has for us, aside from creating a fantasy of how lovely it might be.
I think that, even gardening in the heat is sort of a valuable thing, in the sense that if you do a little bit at a time, a lot of people talk about every weed they pull up is another worry, another problem in their life that suddenly dissolves. So I think, you've had a hard morning. It's hot out. It's really muggy.
I've had a hard few years doing this very thing.
And certainly
I have no inclination to write philosophically about the work, although I'm sure it's good for me and my spirit.
Elizabeth, I thank you for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. It is, or has been said of Jefferson, Peter, that, you know, people who look at him from a perspective of his work as a minister and as his work as a an ambassador and as a president wonder how it was he ever found the time to meet anybody, eat anything, do anything, because he was writing all the time.
Right, and as I mentioned, the Garden Book, as published by the American Philosophical Society, it's some 700 pages long. And, you know, we do have romantic images of gardening, or that can very, going back to the land. And as I referred to earlier, I use the images of, it's like war out there sometimes, especially on a hot, humid day in Virginia in the middle of July.
Do you fight the battle wearing the same clothes and using the same tools and you know, sort of period-type gardening, or what's your philosophy for tackling the enemy, as it were?
Yeah, we don't do that. We're not a living historical farm, and one of our chief goals is to preserve a historic plant collection. And we don't do things in period costume, for example, at Monticello, I guess, because we are there to more interpret the past rather than represent it in a first-person sort of manner. We kind of regard ourselves as all scholars looking back on the past rather than people doing imitations of the first person, so to speak.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join my conversation this hour with Peter Hatch. And next to Burnside, Louisiana, Linda's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi. My husband and I went to work at Homer's House Plantation in 1976 as caretakers and gardeners, and can share the joy with the old traditional plants that have been there for many, many years. Huge live oaks and everything, but
what kind of shape was it in back in 76?
It was in it needed work, and we've been doing that work for a long time, but 2 years ago we were purchased by a new owner who dumped a ton of money in it, and not only the flower gardens, but they've just installed a traditional vegetable or kitchen garden, very rustic, near the very formal garden, and visitors are just loving it. We're cutting some of the vegetables out and serving it actually in the little restaurant that's there. And as for attire, my husband wears a white long sleeve shirt rolled up halfway and just lets it flap in the hot sun, which he's doing right now. And it is like war in the summertime down here.
Is it hard to know, Linda, for you, what kind of gardening was done? If what you're doing is hoping to give visitors there a little bit of an insight into how the plantation might have been run back in its earlier days, is it difficult to know what was grown and what wasn't, what can be planted and what can't?
Sure, we don't have any records like he does with Thomas Jefferson, and the main house was finished in 1826, and of course Jefferson died in 26, but we have a lot of folks who like to come and share their information, their knowledge with us, and my husband, this kitchen garden is only 2 years old, but he's still doing a lot of research, and we are getting a lot of old traditional herbs and plants in there, and people are really enjoying it.
Peter, is there a community of people like yourself and Linda who kind of exchange information on how you maintain these kinds of gardens?
Oh, sure. There's I've been active in an organization called the Southern Garden History Society for years, and there's the New England Garden History Society, and the idea of scholarship in garden history has become a new and really fairly vital field over the last 20-25 years. And another role that looks into the past, another way you do that is through archaeology, which we used a great deal to recreate the kitchen garden at Monticello.
What do you mean, archaeology?
Well, when you dig into the ground, you leave lasting imprints, and often in terms of the texture, the color of the soil. And so hundreds of years later, you can go back and you can find stains in the ground where fence posts were, which are very a great indication of the bones of a garden. Or in some cases,
stains in the ground. I would never have thought that any kind of discoloration I see in the soil was an indication of that sort of thing.
Right. It often means that the soil has been dug up, or else it often means that there's been decaying of some sort of organic matter, often the trunk and the roots of a tree. And in a south orchard at Monticello, archaeologists very carefully using the trowels were able to uncover some 60 stains in the ground that sort of reflected a map that Jefferson had drawn, a grid map, and they corresponded really closely. So lo and behold, although the orchard of Jefferson had disappeared, we found it archaeologically through this sort of exacting study of the stains in the ground. But the other documentation, the written documentation, is sometimes sort of a mixed blessing, because Jefferson's ideas evolved so much over his lifetime, and he'd also talk about doing a lot of stuff that he never really actually executed. And that's why the field of archaeology is important, because it often can confirm or verify that something that Jefferson talked about had actually been executed.
1-800-423-TALK. Peter Hatch is my guest. We're talking about the garden at Monticello. We're going next to Charlottesville. And Nelson's joining us on the line. Hi, Nelson.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to state that I completely support the claim that there's a definite correlation between Jefferson's patience in his gardening and the way that our government works. And I think that's a strong statement to the slow and deliberate process and the patience that it takes to make a country work.
Maybe we should elect more gardeners then.
Something like that, but I just thought I should ring in and thank the head gardener. I'm not even sure what the gentleman's name is.
Peter's his name.
Oh, Peter, thank you very much. I'm up at Monticello often, and the garden is a great addition, and they work very hard to keep it in its natural state. So I just wanted to mention on that, and I definitely do think there's a correlation between his gardening and our government, not just his government.
Yeah. Peter, will you ever take something like the Declaration of Independence and look at one of the better-known political documents that Jefferson is known for to see if, in fact, you can see those kind of links that Nelson's talking about?
Well, certainly, you know, Jefferson's ideas on nature were inherent to the Declaration of Independence. It was sort of natural law, and there's a lot of need to sort of interpret what he was meaning by that. But certainly, I think you can see the democratic Jefferson and the designs for the landscape at Monticello, but you can also see a lot of different aspects of him. Jefferson, in many ways, worked with the landscape. He had a series of roads called roundabouts around the top of the mountain, and they all conformed to the contours of the land. They didn't go uphill or downhill. It was sort of a gentle enforcement of order onto the landscape. His designs for the flower gardens at Monticello include the serpentine path that goes around the west lawn. And it was a real revolutionary idea to start making gardens that were not an imitation of architecture, but rather were an effort to duplicate picturesque landscape paintings of late Renaissance painters. Gardening as an imitation of nature versus gardens as an imitation of architecture. And Jefferson was always oscillating between the two, actually. So you see a lot of, you know, these themes that can be corresponded with political ideas.
I'm just sort of mulling over what you said about natural law, because a part of natural law is an acknowledgement that there is only so much you get to change, and the rest you have to adapt to. I mean, that's very much a political idea at the same time.
Right, and the difficult thing is Jefferson is all things to all people. I mean, he's a conservative to conservatives and a liberal to liberals, and really digging to find him is incredibly complex, because you can dig and dig and dig, and you find these fascinating things throughout, but it's hard to come up with the definitive final answer to who Thomas Jefferson was.
Is that because there may not be an answer to that question, that he was such a thinker, dreamer, experimenter, and scribbler that he ends up being all of those things and none of them at the same time?
Yeah, and to me therein lies his appeal, that he's not a figure that's made in cement. He's a very elusive figure, and he can mean so many different things to so many different people. And he was a poet. His legacy is as a writer. You know, if George Washington was the sword of the Revolution and Patrick Henry the mouth or the tongue of the Revolution, you know, Jefferson was the pen. And you know, I think his literary works are the thing that are really going to endure.
All right, Connection listeners, if he was the pen, he was also the trowel and the shovel and the man who would bring grapes and try and make them work, who would have a contest with his fellow gardeners to see who could get the first bowl of peas to table in the summertime. We're talking this hour with Peter Hatch, who is the Director of Gardens and Grounds at Monticello. Peter is himself an author. Books include The Gardens of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, The Fruits and Fruit Trees of Monticello. Peter also lectures nationally and has written a lot of articles on the gardening at Monticello, in every case never stepping that far away from Thomas Jefferson, who was the man who conceived of them. This hour, we're talking about the link between those gardens, that man's thinking, and our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you with us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support for The Connection.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection, and our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 this hour. Talking about Jefferson's Garden at Monticello with Peter Hatch, who's in charge of it now. And we're going next to Boston. George is with us. Hi, George.
How are you?
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I grew up in Charlottesville before I moved to Boston, and one thing you did in Charlottesville is anytime any relative came to town, you'd all go to Monticello or to one of the vineyards. And the thing we heard at each one of those places every time we visited was that Thomas Jefferson essentially single-handedly saved France's wine crop, basically, their wine grapes, with Virginia grapes, brought them over to France during a blight, and had them planted or transplanted to there or grafted onto their vines.
So brought them first from France, kept them going, kept them healthy during the blight, and then took them back to France.
Yes, that's the impression that we were always, I guess, given growing up there. And I just wanted to know if there's any truth to that, really.
Peter?
Well, probably not. historically, they're just different eras. We have native grapes in eastern North America that have a native insect called phylloxera, and it's like an aphid that chews the roots of our native grapes. Really doesn't hurt our native grapes, but there's also a European grape called Vitis vinifera that makes the great wines of the world, the Cabernets and the Sauvignons and so forth. And in the later part of the 19th century, 50 years after Jefferson died, there was this great disaster in the vineyards of France when American vines that had been introduced into Europe carried the phylloxera, and it totally destroyed, or just about destroyed, the French wine industry because the phylloxera, the aphids, went in and began devouring all the vinifera grapes. And the solution to that came really simply also from North America. The problem came from North America, but also the solution. And the solution involved grafting the European grape onto American rootstock. And Jefferson didn't have too much to do with that, unfortunately. We'd love to have him as the savior of the French wine industry, but in fact, he was a great proponent of American viticulture, American wine growing, and he said amazing things like, "No nation is drunken when wine is cheap, and wine is indispensable to my health." And now that Virginia wine has become such an important industry, Jefferson's legacy is often recalled in association with it.
Are there any of the vines, as a matter of fact, is there anything left at Monticello that was planted by or during Jefferson's time and still alive?
There's not much. There was 100 years between Jefferson's death and the purchase of Monticello by the foundation that runs it today. And most things really disappeared, although the house was fairly well preserved. But we have some trees, a giant tulip poplar tree, a species that Jefferson referred to as the Juno of our groves. And there's a red cedar tree that grows in the West Lawn that also survives from plantings. And then there's a variety of flowers that are growing naturalized. There's a tulip called the Florentine tulip and a flower called the blackberry lily, Bellum Canda chinensis, that are sort of naturalized in the landscape, but not much else. It's a harsh place, the mountaintop, and there was a certain amount of decay in the landscape after Jefferson died.
We're going back to our callers. Well, we're not going far. We're going to Charlottesville, Virginia. Kevin's on the line. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. My question is in reference to the writing that was quoted earlier by Thomas Jefferson, in which he said, "The greatest service which can be rendered any country is to add a useful plant to its agriculture." I was just wondering if maybe it's time to reevaluate the rationality of that statement, given the danger that we now know of invasive species and the impact that they've had on our agriculture.
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond to that. I think that the invasive species issue is really quite a profound one today because we're become at the mercy of these introduced pests, and in many ways Jefferson gardened in sort of an age of innocence before a lot of insects and weeds and diseases had been introduced into North America. And people are always asking, well, what exotic invasive did Jefferson introduce? And in fact, we're very lucky because there's very few things that he brought into North America that escaped and became serious problems. But it is a big issue. But I still think we need to introduce plants. One of the great we generally rely on plants in terms of our agriculture, our economic agriculture from other parts of the world in eastern North America, and there's a lot of exceptions. But we don't really do enough with native plants, and it's ironic that we have a lot of native blueberries and native pawpaws and native mulberries, and they really haven't been improved by gardeners over the centuries. And if they were improved, I think they'd be more resistant to a lot of the pests and diseases that have been introduced. So I think introducing plants can also mean improving our native plants, and I think that's a real lot of possibilities involved with that in terms of improving our agriculture.
There was a story in the Boston Globe just this morning, Kevin, about Japanese knotwood, which is taking over some of the green space that was left by Olmsted's design. I just reminded of it as you made your call. I mean, when you talk about the invasive species, Kevin, what would you say? That maybe there's enough here now, or what?
Well, I tell you, I was in a course, I'm a student here at UVA, and I was in an environmental science course last semester, and we had a professor come and just speak about the dangers, and his stance is personally that there should be no introduction of non-native species to any environment whatsoever.
And does that include people? Does that include us?
No, I don't think it was people, but he did mention, like, in Virginia, for example, the state tree is the dogwood, and he said that many people are not aware that there was maybe it was a Korean dogwood, I'm not sure, that was introduced to the state, and it is now completely overtaking our native dogwood, and he said it's only a matter of time before it is completely wiped out. So, I mean, I just think that people need to be more aware of the danger that is involved in invasive species. And I know he runs an organization.
Well,
in which,
the rules are pretty strict on that, are they not, Peter, in terms of what, you know, you're allowed to bring in if you've just come from a vacation in Indonesia or something?
Well, they are fairly strict, but that hasn't really halted the flow of a lot of just horrible problems that I have to deal with every day. And it indeed is an issue, but there's not really any kind of simple solution to it. We can't put a huge wall around our borders and just wipe out any kind of biological entity that might want to come in.
You said something a minute ago I want to come back to you. Were there fewer garden pests that Jefferson would have had to deal with 200 years ago?
Yeah, there's no question that there were, because a lot of our worst pests, are, as this gentleman's talking about, are things that were introduced from foreign shores, and when they got here, there was no sort of controls for them. You know, from the dogwood blight to the chestnut blight to the mussel that's destroying, in part, the Great Lakes. And also our native pests. We have native pests, and they didn't really become a problem until civilization and agriculture and created this sort of false environment for them to spread. So there was sort of an age of innocence in terms of pests for Jefferson, but that doesn't mean he didn't have problems with pests at the same time.
1-800-423-8255, next to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Nathan's with us. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. My question is, did Jefferson plant seeds at Monticello that were brought back by Lewis and Clark on their discovery expedition to the West?
Oh, yeah. You know, that was one of Jefferson's great accomplishments, and indicative of his promotion of the natural sciences was his sponsorship of the Lewis and Clark expedition, which was in part a botanical exploration. And there were horticultural plants, that is, garden plants, that were actually brought back and propagated by a nurseryman, a friend of Jefferson's named Bernard McMahon in Philadelphia. And Jefferson also cultivated a number of things brought back by Lewis and Clark at Monticello, including a variety plain Indians vegetables, beans and corn and squashes. And it's really an interesting story because the expedition itself was sort of fostered through that difficult winter at Fort Mandan of 1804 and 1805 through the purchase of Indian corn. And this is as far north as you can grow corn. And the Mandan and the Arikara Indians had developed these specific crops to grow in this incredibly harsh climate. And you know, the great irony of the Lewis and Clark expedition was that Jefferson hoped to turn Native Americans into yeoman farmers. And here, that is in the northern Dakotas, was this ultimate agricultural community that was very, very sophisticated. And so really the Lewis and Clark expedition in some ways was the beginning of the demise of that culture. Reflecting again, Jefferson's experimental bent was the fact that he was growing all these Lewis and Clark plants at Monticello to see how they did. And he was ever so much the empiricist. There was a bean variety that he liked to some extent, but he decided that it wasn't as good as some of the others, so he kind of ditched it. He threw it away. which reflects how Jefferson didn't have that much sentimentality sometimes about plants. They were either good or they weren't. This could have been a plant from the moon, but Jefferson was rejecting it because it didn't quite have the qualities that he was looking for.
Nathan, I don't know if you're still there, but I mean, are you sort of, are you like me, kind of caught up in the idea of the old seeds and you know, the connections that they provide us to centuries past?
Yes, that's primarily what the interest is. I just wondered if there were any surviving plants or plants that went on to grow and become more developed as they were cultivated in the eastern part of the country once he brought them back, and that might still be today in our culture.
Well, Peter, you sell seeds at Monticello, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Then in a lot of, we sell actually species that were collected or first seen by Lewis and Clark, including a variety of flowers, the Galardias, and Lewisia is named after Meriwether Lewis, and Clarkia named after William Clark. So it was a marvelous expedition. There's great stories that evolve from it, and a real example of Jefferson's promotion of the natural sciences and the interest in importing and introducing new plants into gardens. There's a currant variety, for example, that Jefferson grew, that's a native of the Great Plains. And in the late 19th century, there was a lot of efforts to develop this into an economic plant, developing larger berries to the currants themselves. And it was actually a horticultural cultivar that was being spread in the trade, but it never really caught on. And it's a great tragedy in some ways that more of our North American plants haven't been improved. And we've seen that in blueberries and strawberries and cranberries, and those are great crops. But we wish we could do that with more things.
Let's go to Boston next. Terry's on the line there. Hi, Terry. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing, man?
Good, thanks.
My question is not nearly as weighty as philosophical as some of the others, but nevertheless it has to do with a personal experience or a personal plant from Monticello. Some years ago, I bought what I thought was a white magnolia bush or tree from the commercial nursery, which I believe is at the foot of the mountain. And brought it home and planted it in Nantucket, which, as you can imagine, sometimes has some unforgiving winds in the winter. And so the plant stayed very shunted and barely survived over a number of years. Then they moved it up against a house on the south side, and it exploded and became, you know, 12, 15 feet high and 5-6 feet across. And it turned out to be a Rose of Sharon. And I guess my question is, could I be mistaken, number one? And what is the history of magnolias and or Rose of Sharon's vis-a-vis Thomas Jefferson?
Well, you know, Jefferson grew both magnolias. He grew three or four, actually, species of magnolias, including the southern magnolia, which has its evergreen leaves. And he also grew the Rose of Sharon, which is it's regarded by a lot of people as sort of weedy, but in fact it's a lovely shrub that blooms at a time when not much else is blooming. But we have a program at Monticello called the Thomas Jefferson Center for Historic Plants, in which we propagate a lot of these Jefferson and Jefferson-era flowers and fruits and vegetables and distribute them to as many people as possible in order to preserve sort of what's called the germplasm of the past. And it also, in some cases, is really a tangible link to Jefferson's own horticultural pursuits, because we'll sell seedlings of the original tulip poplar, for example. But we're glad, although there's some confusion here about what the plant was, we're glad that a piece of Thomas Jefferson is sprouted and growing in Nantucket.
800-423-8255 we're next to Boston. Jay's joining us. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I have a question for Peter. We talked earlier about how some of Jefferson's political views might have been influenced by his gardening, and I myself am a gardener and know that there's an interplay there. I wondered for Peter whether he felt that gardening had influenced his political views. I'm not asking whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. I'm just wondering if you see any interplay between them.
That's a really interesting question. Because I'm a great optimist, which to me is sort of a liberal phenomenon in some ways. I believe that the failure of one thing is repaired by the success of another. I believe in freedom, and the plants will grow, and sometimes under benign neglect. But I also see the need for, you know, the need for a lot of control out there. That that gardening, there is a conflict between nature and the garden, and in the garden, in order to make it a garden, in some ways you have to be pretty brutal or pretty ruthless in weeding out the undesirable things, and that's a much more of a conservative issue, I think. So you see a little bit of both in my own political beliefs that have been fostered by my interest in efforts in horticulture.
All right, Jay, turn your own cards up here. Does gardening affect your politics?
You know, it's hard to know what's chicken and what's egg, whether I'm the sort of gardener I am because I'm politically the sort of person I am. But I think definitely there's something about that feeling you get as a gardener that there's only so much you can control, and the rest you really have to trust in the plants and in nature to know the right thing. I think that is close to my sort of more populist views, that I do trust the people to eventually know what's good for them. You know, I'd say that's the main way that it affects me. And another is just that feeling that I can't bear to throw anything away in the garden. I can't bear to throw a plant away. So I guess I like to feel there's a place for everybody in our culture, maybe.
Well, Jefferson was something of a populist, Peter. I don't know if you see that in the garden that you work in every day.
Oh, sure, certainly. There's no question about it. You see, you know, democratic ideals, and you see certainly the scientific and the experimental. And you know, Jefferson looked to the Greeks and the Romans a lot for his political as well as his natural inspiration. And you know, the idea of the yeoman farmer was certainly a classical point of view that involved a lot of faith in the future and a lot of optimism in the natural inclinations of mankind, but also in the fact that science is a valuable thing for bettering humankind, and that the culture of the earth is a noble enterprise.
I have a friend who's both an artist and a gardener, and he always talks about how much he likes sort of working with plants that are 18 inches in front of him and then sort of standing up and seeing the whole vista, and that kind of comparison in the garden. I can imagine you doing much the same thing in the work that you do. I envy you. What a nice job.
Yeah, it sounds like this incredible, you know, a lot of people do envy my position, but in fact, it's hard work.
Peter, I thank you for being with us.
Uh-huh. Enjoyed talking with you.
Peter Hatch is Director of Grounds and Gardens at Monticello and author of The Gardens of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello and the Fruits and the Fruit Trees of Monticello. The program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Matt Lieber, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Help this week from Addie Goss and Maura Kelly. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support for NPR.